Okay, I'll say Shabbat Shalom. We'll go ahead and everybody ready to dive into the Word?
Yes.
We left off last time at the end of chapter 22. Again, a meaningless chapter break. So we're going to go into chapter 23. It's just a continuation of God giving Moses his right rulings for him to write down and give to the children of Israel. I'm going to move kind of fast today. I got to stay on track to get through. I want to try to get through the whole chapter. So just remember, take your notes as you go along. Any principles, anything that pops up, write them down so we can talk about it later. Quite a few of these are pretty easy to understand, really. They're, you know, in terms of the reasoning behind them and the application. But let's get started. Look here at the first three. Exodus 23, verse 1 says, "You shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute, so as to turn aside after many, joining with many, to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute." So immediately you can kind of see how this flows from the broader, you know, language of the Ten Commandments. The idea is one is not to be untruthful or partial. In other words, not unjust in any way. So this is very applicable to each and every one of us on a personal level. We're not to engage in these behaviors. Why? Because Yehovah desires justice. So think about this in terms of the broader context of society as a whole. If you have, just systemic lying and fraud and misrepresentations, gossiping, all this kind of stuff, justice is lost in that. That justice, it's hidden in the deception. So these verses very much apply to judicial integrity. Within a society, we need that. That is, this very much applies to the proper behavior with witnesses, with judges, lawyers, litigating parties, right? It's very impactful in that way. But at the same time, these instructions are broad enough really to be everyone's guide in terms of understanding morally what is right and wrong. Many of the rules that we have encountered so far have been kind of bound up, if you will, in Hebrew culture. But these are not. These are very plain. They're very contemporary, timeless, if you will. Look, don't be a party to false rumors, okay? Don't help someone validating a lie. Don't do wrong just because that's what everybody else is doing. Don't make the majority what's popular in the majority become right just because of a majority. You don't administrate justice one way for a rich man, another way for a poor man, right? I mean, that's what it's saying. So with that in mind, then, we can surely have eyes to see what happens when these things are ignored, because it's all around us. It's really the turning away from these very rules that are one root of the declining are declining societies. They are declining all over the world. And in modern terms, what God is speaking against here is political correctness. You know, groupthink, relativism, favoritism, yes, racism, but also tolerance and appeasement. He's speaking out against that. This whole idea of the ends justify the means kind of thing. We even have denial that evil even exists now. These terms are the very definition of human secularism or humanism. which is, you know, just, it's a political and social philosophy. It's very prevalent in Europe. We're seeing it now being pushed here in the States. Secular humanism is the polar opposite of true Christianity. And so as you embrace and live a life based on God's word, you become more and more separated from this ideology of secular humanism. There is it's a definite separation. And we are not to follow that crowd, as it says in verse 2. Because if we're to really step back and be completely honest about it, we would have to admit it is our human nature to follow the crowd. It is our nature to want to fit in, right? And if that wasn't us, why would he have to address it? But he did. These rules that we're looking at, as we embrace them, it sets you apart from the rest of the world. This list of laws, if you want to call them that, in fact, ensured by Yehovah himself, something that in the modern church today is being looked down upon, and that is division. What I'm saying is Yehovah set out to accomplish this very purposefully. Okay? It's direct. The simple fact is that God creates his kind of unity. Get this. God creates his type of unity with division. He creates unity with division. I know that sounds weird, because what he has set up here is principles that are by their very nature divisive. They're dividing lines. Because consider, man is given a free choice to stand on one side or the other. If he stands on the side of God's principles, then he is in unity with God. But he's in conflict with man. If he stands on the other side, he's in unity with man, but in conflict with God. The reason that Israel, both physical and spiritual Israel, has always been an outcast to the world is because, generally speaking, they dedicate themselves to following Yehovah regardless of the consequences. And that automatically puts them and anyone else that wants to do this in conflict with the world. In the same way, the reason that the mainstream church has lost its power is because it has stopped being an outcast. It seems like the goal of the church itself has to become as close and as attractive to the world as possible. Kind of camouflaging itself almost, and still trying to maintain this aura of religiousness. The current era of the megachurch is simply this culmination of enlightenment, I guess, these philosophies and man's desire to never divide, but always try to find a way to unify through compromise. Compromise and consensus has replaced unity. We're trying to get there, but we're doing it exactly the wrong way, right? Majority rules have replaced God's rules. Tolerance has replaced our obligation to discern between good and evil. So yeah, in creating unity, lasting unity, division is required. See, you must divide those who are willing to be unified under a righteous structure from those who disregard it. It is by design divisive. Yeshua said, "Take up your stake and follow me." Translation, if you're not an outcast, you're not doing what I told you to do. Let's look at some more. Starting in verse 4, we see many examples of the Mishpat where we where we get instructions that that are usually credited to Yeshua later, but it started here first. You see that a lot. Anyway, verse 4. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. We're talking about justice. You see that here? Because just because the person that owns it is your enemy, it doesn't mean that it's not his ox, that it's not his possession, just because you don't like him. Your feelings or relationship with that person doesn't change their right to their personal property. Yeshua later said this, I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use and persecute you. See, finding an enemy's lost possession would usually, in the flesh, result to something like, finders keepers. Because you know what? That enemy of mine doesn't deserve it. Right, he's getting what's his just dessert. Right, and I mean that's kind of our attitude. But you know, Yeshua says no. Not only you shall surely bring it back to him, but then you shall pray for them, you shall love them, you know, and you shall bless them. Verse 5. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. Here we have just more justice. This time it's tied not only to our attitude towards our enemies, but also to the animal. Is it the animal's fault that you hate the owner? No. So is it just for you to refrain from helping it just because you don't like him? So when you pause and you consider these things, you see how it can shape your thinking. It can, as you can see how he considers things. We find another instruction often thought to be anti-OT and occurring only in the NT, and that is to be merciful and help the poor. Verse 6, you shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. The OT has just as much or more to say about mercy and grace as the NT does. Okay? When we talk about people being vulnerable and the grace and the love and the mercy that you should extend to them, this is interwoven through all of this. You know, Yeshua didn't come, as we know, to abolish the Mishpat, to abolish the law, the Torah, any of God's instructions. It's his instructions. In fact, Yeshua, honestly, was the most Torah-observant person to ever walk the face of the earth. Okay? Every saying of Yeshua either came verbatim or in principle from what he had already said before. He changes not. Verse 7 says, to keep yourself far from a false matter, do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. So again, we see how justice is so important to Yehovah. Not only are we to not utter false matters, we are not to support them or be involved in them in any way. Do you see how it's divisive? There's choices here. There's a line that's drawn, and it's by design. Notice the very words of Yeshua. In Matthew 3, verse 12, he says, his winnowing fan is in his hand. He will thoroughly clean out his threshing floor and gather his wheat into the barn, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. And in Matthew 25, verse 32, he said, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. Has anyone besides me ever sat and thought about what God is going to use to determine what a sheep is and what a goat is, what wheat is and what chaff is? I mean, you really do want to be on the right side of this line, don't you? There's division. Well, there's good news. God doesn't keep us in the dark. Because Yeshua said, very simply, he said, follow me. The most Torah-observant person to ever walk the face of this planet said, follow me. Do as I do. He didn't say parrot me and just say what I say. He said, follow. Follow me. And they called him a shepherd. And they called him a teacher. What do sheep do? They follow, don't they? Sheep do that. They just follow. And Yeshua is a shepherd. And we're to follow him in what? In his ways. His right rulings. His ways of doing things. That's why we're here. That's what we are reading. You get that? Is how to follow. This is not how to be saved. That's such a frustrating thing. It's not how to be saved. So you people look at the law and they think, boom, 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 these are the things I got to do. And you know, if I don't do them, I'm not saved. Get all of that out of your head. That's done. We have a teacher. We have a shepherd. We are saved. Now we are to follow. Follow what? Read it. The ones that follow are the sheep. You want to know how he knows? Well, the sheep follow, the goats don't. He doesn't even have to do it. They separate themselves in that sense. And so there will be this division on purpose between the sheep and the goats. Why? So that there can be unity within the sheep. Yehovah creates unity with division. All right, one more in this section, verse 9. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger. You should, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. In verse 9, God reminds Israel that they were at one time foreigners and strangers in a cruel and unjust land. They have been exposed on the receiving end of probably the greatest example of how not to treat a foreigner, right? And so they need to remember that. And as we discussed before, God was laying the foundation here for the Gentiles to later then become Israelites. I mean, in two ways, not just in the physical sense by becoming a citizen of Israel, but also in the future spiritual sense that Yeshua's death on the stake would provide this ability for Gentile believers and Hebrew believers to come together for spiritual Israel. So we're not to oppress a stranger. Be nice. Next, in verses 10 to 12, we're going to see the principle of the Sabbath being applied in a very physical, practical, kind of earthly sense. Verse 10. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may rest. and the son of your female servant, and the stranger may be refreshed. In Genesis, we see God setting up the Sabbath principle of 6 days of work and 1 day of rest. Something's beeping in there, guys. Somebody cooking something? You got a timer on? Okay. Where was I? Oh, well, in Genesis, he gave us the principle of the six days on, 1 day off. The seventh day he made holy, and I want to make this very, very clear. It wasn't symbolically holy. It's not symbolically holy. It is literally holy. Literally. This time that we're in, it's holy. It's not a symbol of anything. When God sets something apart for him, it's holy. Yet Yeshua told his followers that this holy time was not made for God. Remember that? He says the Sabbath was not made. It was made for man, right? Why is that? Well, God's holiness, he exists in that all the time. So he didn't have to set apart 1/7 of the week for there to be holiness. For him, he's existing in holiness all week. What he's doing is he's inviting us into his holiness once a day, or once a week rather, in that day. See, he didn't need it for him. He made it for us to be able to enter his holiness because we can't without it. We can't, as I've said a zillion times, make anything holy. Only God can make things holy. Okay. So, this statement, though, that is made, that's something I can kind of clarify a little bit. Because there's a whole bunch of debate out there about that statement. Does that mean that Yeshua was focusing on the physical aspect? Because it was made for man, it's just a physical thing. So that's how they look at that. Well, it was made for man. It was made for a physical purpose. Or was it, because he made it holy, was it a spiritual purpose? And there's this debate. Well, why does there have to be a debate? There's the reality of duality all the time. Every principle of God, every instruction, his every action seems to have this earthly, physical side to it that is a representation or a reflection of the spiritual reality. The Shabbat was declared holy in a purely spiritual essence. It's not symbolic, it's literally holy, okay, and set apart. But it also serves a very tangible, physical purpose of being a day of rest, a day of rejuvenation for all living things, not just man. So in verses 10 through 12, we see the Sabbath principle applied not just to days and weeks, but also years. And notice that the benefits are applied to plants and even the soil that they grow in. Use the ground for 6 years and then let it rest the seventh. Then it's applied to animals. Work 6 days and rest the seventh. Why? So that the animals can rest too, so that your ox and your donkey may rest. And then finally to people. And it includes foreigners, Gentiles, anyone under your control. Work 6 days and let them rest on the seventh. But you need to understand the spiritual holiness of the seventh day Shabbat is really only relevant to the sheep, to God's people, to the bride. That's why it's a sign. Let me explain. Again, there's basically two aspects of the Shabbat, a day of physical rest and a day of observance of a God-commanded holy time to come in and be with him in his appointed time. The first is all about a physical benefit. The second is all about a spiritual benefit. Because of the way Yehovah designed things, it's his choice. Humans, animals, plants, even the dirt of the earth, he says that a regular rest should be employed to rejuvenate. One can be an atheist and benefit from resting one day in seven. And in that case, they're right. Just pick a day. Doesn't matter, right? You're going to get the physical benefit of it. Animals, plants, the dirt, and humans that are not part of God's people are restricted to only the physical benefit of the Shabbat. If one wants the spiritual benefit of the Shabbat, the benefit that comes from observing the Lord's command time to enter into his holiness, to be holy as I am holy, then one has to enter that time and treat that time as holy. If you want the spiritual benefit, you have to treat it the way that it's been set apart. Anyone who recognizes the God-ordained benefit of resting one day in seven will be blessed by it from a physical standpoint no matter what day they choose. The same for an atheist or a plow horse. But there is one day, and only one day, that brings with it the spiritual benefit that the Lord has ordained. And that particular day, that particular slice of time that the Lord set apart, is the seventh day Shabbat. And observing that time for rest is another dividing line, isn't it? It's why Yeshua said that the Shabbat is a sign of his people. It's the sign of the sheep, the sign of the wheat. It's the sign of the relationship between you and God, one as creator and creator, of teacher and disciple, shepherd, sheep. What do all of those analogies have in mind? One is controlling, saying this is what you do and how you live and you do it. Every one of them. And so with that relationship, we transition then, as we move forward here, to Yehovah giving instructions on how to relate to him. We've seen a lot of how we relate to each other. Now we're going to see a little bit about how we relate to him. And he starts by reiterating, once again, that other gods are not to be tolerated. Verse 13 says, "In all that I have said to you, be circumspect and make no mention of the name of other gods, nor let it be heard from your mouth." Thus far in the Torah, we have been told not to make images of other gods, not to worship other gods, and now not to even talk about or invoke the names of other gods. This seems to be a very straightforward statement. Don't let the names of other gods come out of your mouth. Yet later we see Israel not only talking about other gods, but making idols and sacrificing to them. In fact, after they went into Babylon, they even adopted the names of the pagan gods. The pagan gods had named the months, or the pagans had named the months after their pagan gods. And after they went into Babylon and they were kind of, you know, caught up in all of that, they adopted that for the Hebrew Bible. And we see them then later on in the Bible using those names for the months. I don't know, guys, but one thing I do know for certain, every time Yehovah refers to a month in our Bible, it's never with a pagan god's name. It's only with the number. It's the first month, second month, third month. So the question is, should we abandon the use of the names traditionally used in the Hebrew calendar? Is that one proper way of applying this? That we should be so careful as to not even utter the name for anything? I mean, hey, you know, you think about it. You say, well, you know, look, I'm not using the name to invoke a god or even remember a god. I'm using that word to refer to something else. So, I mean, you know, what if there was a pagan god named Scissors? Would we have to call Scissors something else? You know, a whatchamacallit or a whomajawatchit, like we're under the sea thing. Anyway, I digress. Ariel. Maybe that's what they were thinking, right? Well, we aren't using the name to refer to a god. See, the Hebrews are just as good at loopholes and justifying as we are, okay? And God was making it as clear as he possibly could that the Israelites were to have nothing to do with other gods, period. Stay away from them. Don't have anything to do with them. That's the principle. We've even talked about that before. When we looked at one of the commands, we said, look, we're not to mess around with the occult. We don't look to anyone or anything in the spirit realm for anything other than to look to God. Okay, no exceptions to that. That's the principle. Now, does this mean that they erred by using the names for the Hebrew calendar? So I started looking at the Hebrew words in this verse, which I do a lot of times. And there is this sense, as I read through the, I'm not going to take the time to put them all up there, but these definitions, there's this sense of forgetting, to being away from or distance yourself from the gods, okay? And so this was pushed to the point that Yehovah doesn't even want you to utter the name, because by uttering the name, it will bring the name, bring the God to remembrance. That's another key word. They translated this to make no mention of the name. But the broader meaning is not to even recall, not to even bring to mind or remember, is as if to do nothing to cause it to be remembered. This is from the Hebrew word zakar. It appears then that Yehovah is saying, put the names of the pagan gods out of your life, out of your mind. Forget them. Do nothing to bring them to remembrance. Give them no memorial. They were never alive to start with, okay? That's this meaning of zakar. So, justifying again. If I didn't know the names of these Hebrew months were also pagan gods' names, because, well, I didn't live way back then, using them would not bring them to remembrance. So, it's not bad then. Is that justifying? Probably. But understand, it's not justifying for me, because I do know that they are pagan gods. And now every time I look at the dumb thing, I think about the pagan gods. Exactly what this says not to do. Okay, so now what? Is there a legal answer to this that I can stand here and say? Or can we just boil this down to a response of the heart? Can we do that? Yeshua says, don't let these things be heard from your mouth. Now, why would he say that? Because he's the only true God. It's insulting to him to have the names of other gods rolling off the tongues of his children. So at that point, does it really matter if it's law? It seems pretty clear that Yehovah just doesn't like it. It's not his preference. It's not something he wants to hear. It's enough for me. And that's why, if you noticed, the name of the month was not on our title slide today. Look, to me, some things are just easy. We don't have to parse it all apart and get all legal about it. just avoid them for no other reason than to just honor Yehovah because he prefers not to hear it. Some of these things, guys, are acts of worship. When we do things, not because we have to, but because we want to honor God, because we want to be in relationship with him and have nothing that interferes with that, then it's just a heart. That's worship. Some things don't have to be a law. Think about this when right before services, right? There's not an 11th commandment that says, thou shalt make thy bed in the morning. There might as well be in my house. I help making the bed, not because it's a law. It's because she prefers it. It makes her happy. Why not? It's a simple thing. Throw the little deal up over the deal and throw the pillows on it. And she giggles because I don't put the pillows in the right place. But you appreciate that.
I do.
You see, I mean, I think just understanding a preference, that's enough. And we have a perfectly good way of referring to the months. We just do it the way God did it. Okay. I don't know. This I don't know how this is landing. Might make for an interesting discussion, but. Because it is. This is ripe. Is this not ripe for justification and loopholes and, you know, all of that? We could probably talk our way out of it. Maybe. I don't know. I got to move on, though. Yehovah is giving instructions on how to relate to him. Remember that. That's where we're at. And he says, 3 times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded you at the time appointed in the month of Abib. There it is, in the first month. For you came out of Egypt, none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of the harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times in the year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. Here, Yehovah ordains 3 pilgrimage feasts. In Leviticus, these are, of course, covered in more detail. We'll get there later. We've looked at it many times. But like the instructions we just saw regarding the physical, earthly purposes of the Sabbath, we see now the physical, national purposes of these 3 festivals. I mean, they have enormous, we know that, spiritual elements to them. We've talked about that at length. But that's not the purpose of these particular instructions about them at this time. These are all about Yehovah ordaining a special set of 3 celebrations that sets Israel apart. Again, he's dividing. And this goes a long way towards establishing a unique national identity for Israel. God knows what he's doing. The celebrations that a society uses, that they engage in, bonds them together. I mean, we have national holidays. We have where everybody stops and does the same thing. Ancient cultures had the same thing. And they honored their deities on usually agricultural cycles as well. But the difference between those feasts and Yehovah's feasts is that these are the only ones that are God-ordained. And you can see that, again, from a physical standpoint, they both divide and unify at the same time. They divide because they are different from all the other pagan celebrations and all the nations around them. But they unify the nation itself. Okay? It keeps them rehearsing year after year the workings and the presence of the true God. And so they're different because they're God-ordained. They're appointed times by Yehovah himself. And this is so different than everything else around them because there's a huge difference between men's appointed times and God's appointed times. And disregarding this difference has caused enormous confusion in Bible interpretation and teaching. I had some thoughts here about looking at how unpacking some of the things that Paul had to say about the holy days that are completely taken out of he's trying to tell them, he's trying to talk about men's traditions, and then people think that he's talking about God's traditions and trying, or God's holy days, trying to do away with them. I'm running out of time, so I need to skip this part. Okay, Exodus 23, verse 18, moving on. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. That's not hard to understand. What are we in the context of? The three pilgrimage feasts, one of which is Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread. And so it's easy to make the connection that he is speaking here of the blood of the Passover lamb. Of course, we know that leaven is to be put out before and kept out during the feast. So, of course, it's with leavened bread. It's expanded later in Leviticus. This just tracks along. We take the Passover with unleavened bread. And we don't, if there's anything left over, I get rid of it, just like they did. So we follow this. But the next verse, kind of tricky. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Where'd that come from? That last little part. And then we've argued about that for centuries. As a tradition, the Jews have taken this so far that they don't allow meat and dairy to be eaten at the same time. And if you do, you have to have two different sets of utensils, or you have to stop your meal, get up, wash them before you go over to eat the other one. And in fact, the really strict sects, they have separate refrigerators for meat and dairy to be kosher. I'm not a follower of Judaism. I don't plan on boiling any animals in milk. So from a physical standpoint, I could pretty much move on from this. But we want to know why, right? We want to know what's the principle here, what's going on. And I read one that said that this was referring to God wanting to make sure that there was no cruelty to animals. So it would be very cruel for a mother to watch her offspring be boiled in milk. In her milk. Any milk, really. But especially her own milk. That is cruel. Boy, that's stuck right in the middle of there, isn't it? He's talking about the holy days, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, don't be cruel to animals. Well, it doesn't flow. It's not contextual at all. I don't buy it. To me, it's one of those things where when people come across things and they don't understand them, they just make something up. And it just seems like that's what they did. Excuse me. But contextually, there's a very good answer, because he's talking about three feasts. It's definitely about the first fruits. So being thankful for the harvest, giving, you know, your best tithe back to God for it, okay? But then we have this statement about milk. It doesn't fit, but it does, because the nations around Israel, they had the same kind of celebrations around the agricultural harvest, okay? Harvest was the same for them as it was for, for the Israelites. And so one of the things that the pagans would do is they would literally boil a young goat in its mother's milk in order to make what they describe as a milk pottage. Then they would take this and they would go out in the fields and they would magically sprinkle it, you know, all over their fields and their vineyards and their gardens for make them fruitful, right, for the next year. So in context, that makes a lot of sense. Yehovah's saying, hey, here's my three feasts. As you keep them, don't do stupid stuff like the other nations around you are doing. Yes, bring in the harvest. Yes, give me a sacrifice. Give me the first fruits of that. But don't go around sprinkling milk porridge all over this place. He's like, I'm the one that brings the harvest, not this nonsense. So the principle here is the same as we've read elsewhere. Do not worship Yehovah in the ways of the pagan nations around you. When you go into the land that I give you to dispossess, do not inquire of their gods. How do you worship them? And we do likewise. It's exactly what he's saying here. It's the same principle. So as we move along to verse 20, suddenly the kind of the tone of the chapter changes. And he moves from ordaining rules and regulations to giving promises. I want to read all of it at once. Yeah, let's do it. You guys are comfy, aren't you? Okay. Verse 20 says, see, I am sending an angel ahead of you to guard you along the way and to bring you to the place I have prepared. How cool is that? Pay attention to him and listen to what he says. Do not rebel against him. He will not forgive your rebellion, since my name is in him. If you listen carefully to what he says and do. Hear that? You think that's a Shema? If you think that's a Shema, you'd be right. If you listen carefully, Shema, to what he says and do all that I say, I will be an enemy to your enemies and will oppose those who oppose you. My angel will go ahead of you and bring you into the land of the Ites, and I will wipe them out. Do not bow down before their gods or worship them or follow their practices. He's just reiterating it again. You must demolish them and break their sacred stones to pieces. Worship the Lord your God, and his blessing will be on your food and water. I will take away sickness from among you, and none will miscarry or be barren in your land. I will give you a full lifespan. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion every nation you encounter. I will make your enemies turn their backs and run. I will send the hornet ahead of you to drive the Hivites, Canaanites, and Hittites out of your way. But I will not drive them out in a single year, because the land would become desolate and the wild animals too numerous for you. Little by little I'll drive them out before you until you have increased enough to take possession of the land. I will establish your borders from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, from the desert to the Euphrates River. I will give into your hands the people who live in the land, and you will drive them out before you. Do not make a covenant with them or with their gods. Do not let them live in your land. Do not let them live in your land, or they will cause you to sin against me, because the worship of their gods will certainly be a snare to you. So there are all of these promises that Yehovah makes them if they do their side of the deal. See, we've read all sorts of instructions and guidance, laws, if you want to call them that, that Yehovah gave the people, and it was all for their own good, all for our own good. And that was our side. That's our side. That's what we're to do. And now we get the benefit, what God promises to do in this relationship. So let's back up here a little. Verse 20. Says that he's going to send an angel. It's a malach, M-A-L-A-C-H, if you're taking notes, M-A-L-A-C-H, to prepare the way for Israel's conquest of the land of Canaan. And he's saying that the people that are to obey this angel because he carries his name. So in other words, this angel either carries God's full authority, or, as is more often taught, this angel was a manifestation of God himself. You know, the Word, prior to him becoming flesh, Yeshua. Now I lean that way, but I'm not prepared to be dogmatic. I don't know. I would say, though, that I don't delve into it real hard, because I don't think it would matter to me much. to know for sure either way. Because either way, whether it's the Word that later became flesh or not, the fact is, it says very plainly that the authority of Yehovah was being exercised. So whatever that form it takes, we can't put God in a box. So what I'd like for you to take from this is this incredible mystery that is our God. He's just amazing. I've kind of come to the conclusion that if ever I get pretty sure that I can comprehend him, I must have it wrong, because you can't comprehend him. God speaks things into existence. He controls every atom, every molecule, every frequency in his universe. And so, listen, God can manifest himself however he decides to do so. Whether it's an angel, a cloud, a burning bush, a prophet, it doesn't matter. And quite frankly, he doesn't care if that fits or doesn't fit into your perception of him. Because you can't perceive him completely. Some things about God just are, and we need to accept it. In any case, Israel was to be unquestionably obedient to this angel. And just as important, as Israel begins to encounter this list of nations that we see here in verse 23, they're told once again to avoid worshiping their gods. In fact, they are to destroy everything about them. And if they do that, hopefully you caught that, then God will be an enemy to Israel's enemy. Yehovah tells them that if they will serve him, that they will make them very fruitful. He'll keep them from falling ill. He'll keep them from having miscarriages. He'll make them multiply rapidly with full lifespans. That he'll put the terror of God in the hearts of enemies before they even arrive, before they even know what's going on. Like an irrational, supernatural fear of Israel will make them run away. But he says, even if there are some that stays, well, I'm going to send some hornets, and the sting of them, well, that'll make them leave Dodge. So he's got your back. Verse 29, we've already read all this, but I'm kind of going back through, says something interesting, that God is going to lead Israel in such a swift victory. He has the ability to cause all of this to just happen very quickly. But he intentionally says, no, I'm going to slow down. Why? Because if I go in there and wipe it all out and you don't come in and inhabit it, the land will, you know, it'll start to get weeds, and then the vineyards will, you know, go away. The wild animals will start to come in. It'll be easier if we just do it a little bit at a time. When you're ready, then I will do this on a, you know, step-by-step rate so that you're prepared. And so I have a question for us in that context for discussion. Has God had to slow down blessing you because you weren't ready? He's got a lot to give us. In verse 31, we're told that the boundaries of the land that God is giving them is going to be gigantic. I mean, plot that on a map, folks. That is a lot of area. And Israel has never in history ever fully possessed all of that land. And we too we do not possess all that God has for us. Verse 32 is talking about not making a covenant with the Canaanite people. No peace treaties, no nothing. Okay, go in there and wipe them out. Now I wonder, had they gone in there and actually wiped them out? See, they used their loopholes, they used their justification, and when they went in there at certain times, they said, well, we need to be merciful. We won't wipe them completely out like God said. That this just doesn't feel right. Well, God has a bigger vision than we do. He has a bigger understanding than we do. What if they had gone in there and completely wiped them out like they said, like God said? Would we have a Middle East crisis right now? I asked a moment ago to notice the if-then nature of the relationship. Because ever since chapter 19, we've been making a covenant. We've seen the terms of that covenant between Israel and Yehovah being laid out. This was not a weird concept to them. In fact, we have a lot of Middle Eastern treaties and pacts and agreements that archaeologists have uncovered. And so there's enough similarities that we know that it's during the same amount of time, but there's these glaring differences between those treaties that were normal with of the nations around them and what Yehovah was doing at Mount Sinai. For one thing, no covenant ever discovered, and I think this is so cool, they've never found an ancient agreement, pact, body of law, anything that was an agreement between man and God, except for this one. It's the only one. Now, why is that? It's because this is the only God that's real. You can't make, listen, if you can't make a promise, if you're not real to be able to execute your responsibilities. A God that doesn't exist can't do anything, so it can't covenant. And I think it's so cool that in these thousands and thousands of these that we have, none of them are with a God. Because they can't be, because there's only one. And he only made one covenant, and there it is. Every document is so cool. It's also something that you find, and I gotta hurry here. I'm sorry. I knew I had more than I bargained for. What was I gonna say? A lot of these agreements, this is the only one that also combines the civil and the moral laws together. In all the other ones, the moral laws are compartmentalized, okay? And the covenant at Sinai was a complete departure, completely opposite of all these other law systems. You know, there's no class system within God's kingdom. But all these other ones, they had, you know, levels, you know, all the way from the monarchy all the way down to, you know, slaves. There's no class system here. You know, and it's a complete departure in other ways too when we get to Sinai. The covenant with Noah, the covenant with Abraham, both of those were promises that were made to God, by God, I'm sorry. They were not unilateral, okay? Or it was unilateral. With this one, it's bilateral, right? So in one, it was completely unconditional because God made the promise. There was nothing on the other side. So the promise is the promise. It was completely unconditional, whereas this is not conditional. We're seeing that. There's divisive lines. There's conditions to this. And so what's all this mean to us? Well, this if-then part of this should be clear now. We have a response to Yehovah, and without it, he is not obliged to produce the promises. In fact, there's other promises that he's given if we don't. That's the negative side. But the more positive side, the far more positive side, are these monumental promises. Look at what he told them, bearing in mind he's no respecter of persons. All these promises apply in principle to us just as much as them. He said he was going to guard them along the way to be your protector. The verse also says that he's guarding you along the way to a place prepared for you. Later, Yeshua comes along and says, "In my house are many mansions." Same thing. I go there to prepare a place for you. And he reiterates being our guard along the way when he said, "I'll never leave you or forsake you." Now what he's saying here? I'm going to guard you along the way to a place I've prepared for you. Tremendous promise. In verse 22, he promised to be an enemy to our enemies. And this is the one where it said, if you carefully, listen carefully and do all that I say. That sentence is translated from, say it with me, Shema. If you will do, then, if you will listen and do, then I will be an enemy to your enemies. If God is for us, who can be against us? See where this, it's all the same. Verse 23 says that he promises to go before you and wipe out the enemies. That's the work of the angel. And I know that the authority of God in the form of Yeshua at his return will completely and totally wipe out our enemies. Verse 25 said that he would bless our food, no sickness. Boy, I'll sign up for that. That'd be nice, right? And I find it very interesting, isn't it? Right here in the covenant, this correlation between I'll bless your food and you'll have no sickness. What do you know? Who'd have thunk it? Verse 26, fertility and long life. This is a promise to prosper and grow society when they're living the way that they should live. But that promise is for us too. Is there any longer life than eternal life? Verse 27, were more promises. Where he said, remember, we read that he would put that the fear, his fear would go ahead so that they would run before they even got there. How cool is that? I started thinking about that, and you know, here's a promise where he's saying, I'm going to take care of things that you don't even know are a problem. I'm going to fight battles for you that you didn't even have to engage in. Maybe you ought to take some time today and thank him in your prayers for stuff he's protected you from you didn't even know he did, that you needed. Verse 28, to enlarge your territory and resources. Listen, guys, what God laid out for them was a huge territory. Huge. Look it up on a map. But that promise here is for us too, here and now. God's not limited. And so what he's saying is, He gave them something to do, and he says, here's all the resources you need to do it. And he says the same thing to us. If he is sending you to do something, he's going to give you everything you need for it. And so what I'm trying to say here, to wrap this up, is that we need to be able to look at these things in both the context of what it meant to them physically, but also to us spiritually, because these are fantastic promises. We want to be in covenant with Yehovah. There isn't anything better, nothing. It's everything. But it is an if-then relationship. And many don't like that. But it's the Word of God. And it's in the best interest of His kingdom. We wouldn't really want it any other way if we understood it. In that context, I want to make one final point, and then we'll circle up. Law codes in those ancient days, as now, tend to be very cold, very sterile, very legalistic in the structure. Unquestioned obedience, without necessarily understanding the reason for a particular law, was common and prevalent at the time. And although it might not have occurred to you before, the way that God gives His instruction, His laws, if you will, were given to the people with warmth, with compassion, with a vision of love and service. It was given rich in symbolism. And the laws, you know, although they don't seem like it, comparatively, we have a lot of explanation and narration on God's law. Why? Because as I've been saying all along, it's the principles behind the law that God is teaching. The purpose of the law, of the Torah, of all of this, was to teach us. In fact, the word Torah means teaching. It's why thinking that Yeshua did away with the law is preposterous. They called him teacher. Well, what do you think he was teaching? How can you follow a teacher and say we're going to throw out his teaching? You can't. That's what this is. It's his teaching. And so while many of the details of the Mishpat are very Hebrew in their cultural content, the principle behind every one of these are they're timeless. They're right rulings, and they would apply to every human being in every culture. Because listen, contained within these right rulings, Yehovah is expressing his love, and he's expressing the basics and the foundation for the way his universe will operate and how his kingdom will operate. Dividing lines are drawn on purpose for us to choose which side we will be on. Choosing to trespass on Yehovah's ways is suicide. Coming into agreement with them, now that's life and peace. Amen?
Amen. Amen.